Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's the fight in. Oh, that was really interesting, mate. Yeah.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Extra Inch. My name is Windy, and I'm joined by my tactics guy, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Hello, mate.
And another special guest, straight from Nathan's Rolodex, it's John McKenzie. Hello, John.
Hello, mate. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for joining us, John. Before I introduce John properly and we speak a little bit about what he does and his background, as you may have heard in our previous episodes, we've got ourselves a sponsor, and they are the OneFootball app, which is a football app available on the App Store and Google Play. They've currently got an article about Heung-min Son, which was actually really informative for me because I hadn't realised that he's going to miss games in the Asian Cup. Nathan, had you realised this, and what the heck are we going to do without Son?
Yeah, we sort of, I read a sort of much earlier in the year that we sort of hatched out a deal with the Asian Games and the Asian Cup. So he missed the last lot of international friendlies and stuck around with us and was fresh and, you know, obviously performed very well against Chelsea on account of that freshness. And yeah, that sort of general deal also includes him going away for a bit in January. But I think you just sort of accept it and that's the way it is. And we do get some back from that. And also, we have the depth in his sort of position that it's not the end of the world that we lose him for a couple of weeks. So it's not too bad.
Yeah, I guess with Lucas now, we're better stocked in terms of direct runners in the final third. So hopefully we will cope and Son won't suffer from burnout. Let's move on to talking about John and his beloved Leeds United, because I think there's so much of interest to say about Leeds at the moment. But John, first, before we start talking about Leeds, can you give us a bit of background about what it is you do and how you got to that point? Because, you know, from our brief chats just before we started recording, you've got a really interesting background that doesn't necessarily lend itself to writing about football. So how did you end up here?
Yeah, it's very much less exciting than you might think. I'll warn you at this point, but I started out my life as a career academic. So that meant that I did my undergrad, did a bit of graduate work, did a bit more graduate work, did a bit more graduate work. So I spent a lot of time in academia, about 10 years in the end. And as part of that, when I was doing my PhD, I ended up doing quite a bit of lecturing on the side, which sort of dragged my PhD out for 6 years, so twice as long as most people spend doing their PhD. When I actually eventually handed the PhD in after those 6 years, I had my Viva, so that's an oral examination with, yeah, stop sniggering. You have this oral examination for two or three hours, with an academic from your own institution and an academic from another institution. At the end of that Viva, mine went on for 3 hours, which is long. They decided they wanted me to spend another 6 months working on my PhD, restructuring this thesis. They liked my argument. They wanted me to add a chapter. They wanted me to take a couple of chapters out, and they wanted me to change the structure, which was nominally fine, I suppose. But when you've been working 6 years on something, that's not really what you want to hear. And the problem was that by this point, I'd pretty much run out of money. And so what happened at this point is I ended up moving into working in doing bar work and pub work around Cambridge, which is where I was, and getting more and more disillusioned with the whole idea of academia. And on the side, I was starting to do a lot more writing about football. And it got to a point where I had decided that I enjoyed writing about football more than I enjoyed working in academia. I wouldn't say I enjoyed writing about football necessarily more than writing about philosophy, but the academic world is a very specific type of existence, and it's very cutthroat and it's very kind of thrust. And I guess I reached a point where I realized actually there was no point in me finishing my PhD. I couldn't afford to do it. I had to get a job, and I ended up getting a job in for a small website called Real Sport that has since pivoted to esports, but I was their football editor for about a year. And so I've sort of ended up in the football media, sort of quite askance after about 10 years in academia.
And the way you described the academic world and community just then, I mean, football writing has gone that way too. It's incredibly cutthroat. There's a real lack of money floating about, which leads to people making decisions that aren't necessarily the best for the reader, but are in the interest of keeping blogs going, websites going. It's become a very difficult world to navigate. Do you feel like your sort of background, your career in academia, has set you up for this kind of world you're now finding yourself in?
I think that there are skills that I've learned during my time in academia that have helped me in the whole football media context, in the sense that, you know, when you spend that amount of time in academia, you're taught how to write well, you're taught how to argue well, you're taught how to think well, and that's obviously generally beneficial in the football media. Not that you can get away with writing things without necessarily arguing well or thinking well, but I've definitely benefited from that side of things. Yeah, but there is that cut and thrust that we've talked about. It is cutthroat. But also, I think a lot of people go into academia with sort of very highfalutin ideas about making a difference in the world. And I guess the longer I was in it, the more I realized that so much of it came down to being, I suppose, a lot less idealistic than I thought it would be. And I think this is a sort of common experience a lot of people have in academia, particularly now, as you've mentioned, you know, there are certain economic, political conditions under the surface of what's going on. And I think that has changed the ability that you can have to be as creative and idealistic as you might have been in other time periods. But also, I think when you're in the middle of it, you start thinking, why am I doing this? I don't feel as though I'm making a huge impact on the world. And when you're in that sort of industry, and one of the main benefits is that you feel as though you can be making an impact in the world, I think it sort of raises questions about why it is that you're there. And so for me, writing about football was, in many respects, like I was attracted to that because it was unimportant. I like the fact that, you know, football at the end of the day does not really matter. It's obviously, and that's why it's important, right? In a weird paradox. But I like the fact that I could write about football, and, you know, if someone disagrees with it, then they disagree with it, and then you move on. Whereas I guess when you're writing about subjects like philosophy and theology, they sort of weigh heavy on you a little bit more.
And I would imagine that there's, when you're writing, like you say, about philosophy, there's a narrow readership there, isn't there? There's a group of academics who are philosophers who will gain, you know, something from your writing, and it might even be held up as a future text for students in the future to read and whatnot and reference, and that must be incredibly gratifying. But the base for writing about football is so much larger. There's such a huge pool of people who have an interest in football. Although it's you know, like you say, matters in inverted commas less, it touches more people and impacts more people, so you can presumably make more inroads with that in that way. I could talk about your career for a lot longer, but I'm conscious that you probably feel a little self-conscious talking about it, and we've got a lot to cover, so we'll move on. And let's move on to talk about another of your projects. Some people may know that you are a moron. Others may not know this. Tell us what Morons is.
Yeah, so Morons is a podcast that I run. We record every week. It's just me and Nico Morales, who I think you had on. Did you have on the last episode? I think, yeah, or maybe the one before last. But it's just me and Nico. We chat about things. We don't really plan a huge amount, and it tends to be about football, although it can be on anything really. We did an episode the other day just on film, and so. Yeah, the idea of, well, so originally I started a team of John O'Shea's when I was at university, when I was still doing the academia stuff, and there was a group of us friends at the university who would go on. We were a bit more of a I guess, a standard football podcast then. We thought of ourselves as being quite different, and we sort of modelled ourselves on asking the questions that, answering the questions that no one was asking, in some kind of, which we thought was really clever at the time. But we were trying to think of interesting angles on what the football media were talking about. So the first episode we recorded was, how good would a team of John O'Shea's actually be? And then we moved on and talked about what sort of player would be the best player to have a team entirely composed of. And we sort of, we did things like that. We tried to take what was being talked about in the media and then give it a sort of irreverent twist. And we ran that for about a couple of years until I moved down to London with my job, and then it sort of died out. But then I'd recorded a podcast with Nico on his old podcast, which is called The Rondo, while I was at university. And for some reason or other, Nico and I ended up recording a few podcasts together, and we just decided to make it into a thing. And it started out as me, Nico, and some guests, but that took ages to edit. So it's just become me and Nico, although it has become more guests recently. So we've had Nathan on the last episode, which will be out at some point when I can get around to editing it. For Nico and I, we share sort of fairly similar views on football and the world. And we just end up having chats about football and anything else that comes into our head. Political stuff will come up here and there, but yeah, if that sounds, it's a little bit off the beaten track of football podcasts. I think we try and just have a conversation. It's a bit more conversational, and the we can go off in tangents anywhere. So I don't know whether or not anyone would enjoy that, but we enjoy it, so that's what matters to us.
I like it a lot. I think it's really unique in its kind of long form style. It's like you said, it's conversational, but it's not just brief conversations. You go deep on all kinds of things, and it's fascinating. And one of the things you have gone deep about, and I've picked up from listening to Morons over the past probably year, is you seem absolutely fascinated by the way that football media works. And I suspect that this is your academic background, wanting to understand why something is the way it is, and trying to create theories around that. Is that a particular thing that plays in your mind? And is that something, where does that come from?
Yeah, I think there's two angles on this. I think one of them is the fact that, you know, whenever we're talking about football, we are doing that. We are talking about football. There is. As I view it, the world of football is a sort of phenomenon that is out there and will be played regardless of whether or not people talk about it or not. But it's the fact that people talk about it that makes it so interesting. And I think a lot of the time we don't really think about what's involved in that, the sort of impact that the way that we talk about football can have on the way that we perceive football or understand football. And I find that, yeah, like you say, there's probably a little bit of my academic interest coming into that, because I spent a lot of the time when I was doing my PhD, I was thinking about what does it mean to perceive the world? What does it mean to experience the world? And how does the way that we talk about the world impact the way that we think that the world is? And the underlying argument of my PhD, or the underlying story that my PhD was trying to react against, was this idea that Protestant theologians have started talking about God in a way that became problematic in terms of the way that you talk about experiencing the world. And as a result of that, atheism happened. And so when you're looking at the world in that sort of way, you're having a keen awareness of the fact that the words that you use can have such a big impact as to essentially change the religious outlook of the majority of people in the Western world, then I suppose that you're naturally going to raise those sorts of questions when you move into something like the football media. So there was that side of things. There was also an offhand comment made by Miguel Delaney when he commented to me once, saying, "Oh, you think you know so much about the industry, but you don't know about the industry." And I sort of took that on the chin and said, "Right, fair enough. Probably don't know enough about the industry, and so I'm going to make it my mission to learn a little bit more about the industry." And what has resulted from that has been another podcast, the Football Media Podcast that I run, where I spend about an hour a week interviewing people from the industry, outside the industry, in the wider industry, just talking about the industry itself. Again, so it's not something that a lot of people will be interested in, but I think that it's absolutely fundamental for people who are working in the media to actually have an understanding of some of the mechanics behind the scenes in the media. And so that's where that has come from, and it's actually led to a lot of eye-opening experiences for me in terms of finding out what's going on behind the scenes and looking at the wider media in general. It's fascinating seeing the sorts of innovations that are going on in so many different areas in the print media, in the digital media, looking at things like marketing models. How do you monetize your models? What kind of impact do the models that we use have on us? Or what impact does ad revenue model have on its consumers? And so I found that really fascinating. And so if that kind of stuff interests you, then head over to Footy Media Pod Twitter feed, which is at Footy Media Pod, I think. And we've got a few episodes up there. They're also on the Team of John O'Shea's platform as well. So if you subscribe to that, you'll get them dropping into your feeds.
Awesome. I think we should probably go and speak about Leeds now, because they suddenly got interesting. You've obviously followed Leeds for a long time, John. Nathan, how excited were you when Leeds appointed Bielsa as their new head coach?
Yeah, no, it was great to have Bielsa in English football. And also, you know, at my mate's club and everything. The idea of, you know, this sort of idealist and theorist in the muddy, gritty championship is, it has sort of returned on that promise. Have been really good to watch. I've watched a few matches alongside John. Yeah, it's been brilliant.
I did a bit of research for this podcast, and that research was listening back to the first ever Extra Inch, which was from 2016, and we spoke at length about Bielsa and his influence on Pochettino. And I just want to point out a couple of things from listening back that aren't necessarily Bielsa specific, but just amused me. So firstly, we bigged up David Luiz. Yeah, that's awkward. We spoke a lot actually about how Pochettino improves players and how that is a thing that happens, and how much he'd worked with Dembele. And yet here we are, sort of, I don't know, what, 18 months, 2 years later, surprised at the rise of Moussa Sissoko. Why are we surprised? This is what Pochettino does. And we spoke about Christian Eriksen as well. He was having a slight dip in form at the time of recording that. And I said some things that I now regret about Christian Eriksen. But if you're interested in Marcelo Bielsa and the impact that he has had on Pochettino, then go back and listen to that first episode. It's quite raw. Nathan, you sound a bit nervous actually when I listen back.
I was, embarrassingly. I really cared about having a good first episode, mate.
Oh, you did. You did a great job. I did less of a great job. I think I've got better with time. And Bardi's just Bardi. What more can you say about Bardi? But it was interesting listening back, and it was quite sweet actually. But let's talk to John a little about Bielsa and how this all came to be. So Leeds got a new owner in 2017. Is there links between him and Bielsa that made this happen, John?
I'm not entirely sure of any explicit link. There may well be links behind the scenes, but I think Andrea Radrizzani clearly took over the club with the express purpose of getting it up into the Premier League. And he's serious about doing that. You know, Andrea Radrizzani is the owner of 11 Sports, who clearly have they have great ambitions in the TV broadcasting realm. So you get from that what you expect from him in terms of his football team, and that is that he wants Leeds to be in the Premiership. Interestingly enough, I do wonder whether or not he might be the sort of manager who gets Leeds in the Premiership and become. I don't want to invoke the spirit of Mike Ashley, but you know, this is a big business owner. He's savvy. He knows what he's doing. He knows that you can get a huge amount of coverage from having your club in the Premier League. The question is going to be, how much money is he willing to put into that? And at the moment, that's fine because we're in the Championship, we're having a great time, we're enjoying the football. But very quickly, it could become, now that we're in the Premier League, if we should get there, what's the owner going to do?
It's all about that sweet, sweet yo-yo money. That's where it's at. Up
yeah,
and down.
Exactly.
That's the way.
Yeah.
The thing with Bielsa over the years has been that he's been seen as a very gung-ho manager in style. He's always had the emphasis on attack. But this year, Leeds have been quite tight at the back, and they have the third best defensive record in the division. They have scored goals, obviously. You'd expect that with the Bielsa team. But is this a sign that he's developed as a manager, or is he just essentially too good for the Championship? How have they been defensively, John?
Yeah, I don't... I don't think that we've been particularly impressive defensively. I think we've benefited from the fact that, I mean, we've benefited from the fact that we have got players who've responded well to Bielsa's approach. We've also been unlucky insofar as we've lost a lot of defenders to injuries, and there's questions raised about whether or not Bielsa's intense training regimes, whatever they may be, have impacted that. But I actually think we've been relatively lucky to be to have such a good defensive record. We're currently playing Stuart tonight. We'll play Stuart Dallas at right back, who is a left winger by trade. We've then got Liam Cooper, who the majority of Leeds fans think is not good enough for the Championship. He is, in fact, our captain. And then we've got a guy called Apo Halme playing alongside him at the moment, who is a, I think he might be 19, Finnish player who made his debut last week because all of our other centre backs are injured. We do have Barry Douglas back. He was injured for a bit, but we've gone from having quite a solid defence to having quite a sketchy defence, and we have conceded some goals because we've quite frankly been all over the place structurally. So I think that our defensive record, it's not coming from, and we're not. It's not as if we're sitting back and we're sitting deep. Particularly more than you might expect. I think we've just been fairly lucky. We also are lucky to have Calvin Phillips playing in a sort of holding role, which becomes almost a centre-back role at times, depending on how many strikers we're playing against. So I wouldn't be too excited about the defensive side of things. It's the attacking side of things that is a lot more exciting for me.
So what kind of formation is Bielsa adopting? He was always a back three manager, and you've just explained there that Calvin Phillips is dropping in to make a back three. Does that mean that essentially he's playing a back four out of possession and a back three in it?
It depends who he's playing against. If he's right. playing against a lone striker, he will tend to play just two centre backs. And if he's playing against two strikers, which you get a lot more in the Championship, he'll go with a back three. But the beauty is that he can just play Calvin Phillips as a centre back, and he likes to play him there because he's good at winning back possession, but he's also a really good transitional player. He's good at moving the ball around, and he's just been so impressive in that role. And I think a lot of Leeds fans were just, again, you've already mentioned how Bielsa takes players and he puts them onto that next level. Calvin Phillips was sort of, he was part of that group of players at Leeds who everyone else moved on and he stayed, and everyone sort of saw him as being the sort of the little pig that stayed at home. But we had Lewis Cook, he moved on. We had Sam Byram, he moved on. We had Charlie Taylor, he moved on. And Calvin Phillips is actually, in many respects, with the exception of Cook, has surpassed the other two for sure. So that's a testament to the way that Bielsa has been managing us. But yeah, so at the moment we've been playing a back four most of the time, and then we sort of play two midfielders in front of that back four, one of which will be Calvin Phillips, who can, as we've said, can drop in between the two centre backs and create a situational back three, and then we'll have like a ball carrier who will sort of sit between Phillips and then the attacking centre midfielder, and it depends on who that will be. We've got a guy called Samu Sayers who's very impressive, but he's sort of dropped off in form, so we now play Matthias Klik, the Polish player there, and then we have Kemar Roof in front of him as a striker, and then we have two wide players, Pablo Hernandez, who is probably the most important player at the club at the moment, and then we have Jani Alioski on the left as a wide midfielder. So that's generally the way we've been setting up, and so a lot of people have made a lot of the Bielsa 3-3-1-3. We've really not played that much this season, but the problem is the formation does become very fluid. So like we've said, if Calvin Phillips drops back between the two centre backs, we're essentially playing with a back five, and so it's kind of and then your wing backs, sorry, are pushing up really high, and then your two centre midfielders are pushing out wide, and you're looking at formations, you're saying it's not really useful to talk about what formation this is anyway.
Nathan, in your watching of Leeds so far, has this been classic Bielsa, or do you see him as a player who's modernised himself?
We sort of got half a question. I think it's worth touching on that when we talked about Bielsa before on the podcast on that first episode, we sort of described him as this sort of, you know, slightly sort of mad fringe idealist. Whose football was maybe not always a reflection of his ideas and something a bit sort of edgier. And I wonder if, you know, either Leeds are a break from that trend, or that trend is dramatically overplayed, and I've been one for overplaying his his El Loco reputation, which is something that he hates.
Why does he hate that,
John?
Do you want me to answer that?
Yes, please.
Yeah,
It's really interesting. He will never use the phrase El Loco in press conferences. He will always say, "Oh, you guys have this nickname about me." He said it the other day. I can't remember what he said. It's something like, I can't remember. He made some kind of really crazy batshit quote that everyone in the press box was like looking at each other, and he basically came out and said, "Yeah, you know, you guys have this nickname for me. So I'm just going to play up to it now." But he will never use the phrase El Loco. And I suspect it's because, you know, he's a smart guy. There is method behind the madness. And I think he gets frustrated precisely because he's being sort of portrayed as that sort of crazy uncle figure on the periphery, when in many respects, his ideas have been extremely generative for other managers. And I guess there's questions to be asked about how does Bielsa sort of fit into the genealogy of managers. And I find that a really interesting question. I know at the beginning of Jed Davis's book, Jed Davis has written a book on Bielsa called, I can't remember what it is, I've got it here actually. It's just called Revolution, or Revolution, The Philosophy of Marcelo Bielsa. But he starts off with a quote from Borges, the Argentinian author, he's talking about translation, and he uses this phrase, the original is unfaithful to the translation, which is obviously the way around that you wouldn't expect it to be. You'd expect the translation to be unfaithful to the original. But I think the point that Borges is making there is precisely this idea that when you make a copy of something, when you move one thing to another and to another frame of reference, you don't have to be exactly this. It doesn't have to be exactly the same for it to be a legitimate copy of that. And I think that's, Jed Davis uses that at the beginning of his book, because that's a really helpful image of how you might talk about Pep Guardiola, or you might talk about Mauricio Pochettino or Tata Martino, or any of these managers that you can reel off who have been influenced by him. How you can then talk about them as being within the same sort of tradition, because I watched Pochettino's Tottenham and it's nothing like watching Leeds. It's very different. I watch Guardiola's Manchester City, it's nothing like watching Leeds. But at the same time, you can see why you might make that connection between the two teams. So I find that sort of question about what Bielsa is like, and how is it that he is so important when you watch him and he doesn't seem to have that sort of extrinsic link to other managers.
If this Bielsa experiment, in inverted commas, pans out, where do you see this ending, John? Because typically he's never stuck around at clubs for too long, 2 years, 3 years, sometimes four. If he gets Leeds up this year, let's say he has a year in the Premier League, what then? Will he want to stay around? Has he given any indication at all as to whether he wants to manage Leeds in the Premier League?
I think he wants to get them up there, and I imagine he would probably want to manage them for a little while at least. And let's not forget, like, Bielsa is, and he's keenly aware of this fact, but he's not a successful manager really at all. He won a couple of trophies in Argentinian football. He spent a bit of time in Mexican football for a bit. He's been in France. He's been in Spain. He failed as a manager. Well, he didn't even get to, I don't think he even lasted 48 hours in Lazio in Italy. And in any of those times, he's not really been a manager who has taken a team from one place to another. He's actually also, I don't think, managed a club who have been able to be promoted. So I guess this is a bit of an outlier. But the phrase, the idea that I always sort of fall back on when I'm thinking about Marcelo Bielsa at Leeds is the sort of Goldilocks effect. And if the Goldilocks effect is in marketing is sort of, you know, if something's too expensive, people won't buy it. But if it's too cheap, people won't buy it. It has to be just right. And I wonder whether or not Leeds United is the team that passes the Goldilocks test for Bielsa, insofar as I think when you put him in a team of players who are very good players, who are elite players, it's really hard to get them believing in the project and believing in this sort of idealistic football, as we've called it. At the same time, if you get a team that is full of players who aren't good enough to play football, then you're not going to be able to work the model either. And I think Leeds maybe falls into that sweet spot where we've got enough good players to be able to play the way that he wants us to play without having so many egos that it becomes difficult to actually make it work. So I wonder whether or not... There's a reason for me telling this this analogy, is that I wonder whether or not, if we do make it into the Premier League and we start bringing in new personnel, whether or not things will change, whether or not it will be hard for, maybe or not, it's whether or not it's hard for Bielsa to manage top flight clubs, because there is an expectation by their players that they are the most important facet of the whole footballing system when they're at a club, and there has to be a huge amount of faith in what Bielsa's doing. And we're going to talk about the idea of a burnout, and from the work that I've done in looking into these sorts of burnouts, a lot of those burnouts seem to be emotional, and I wonder whether or not, again, that's a question that's going to come up, whether or not the intensity of working with Bielsa over a certain amount of time can actually take its toll, and whether or not by the time he gets into the Premier League, if he should do that, and I think it's by no means certain that he's going to do that, then that will be the questions that will be asked. How is the team going to function within the Premier League under those conditions?
Let's do that now, because I do think it's a fascinating topic. Nathan, when Pochettino took over at Spurs, there was this almost obsession that we would suffer from the burnout. We just would, because he demands so much of his players in training, on the pitch, double sessions, etc., etc., using a very small core group of players, which would inevitably lead to them not having enough rest time. Has it panned out that way?
Well, initially, yeah, the suspicions and the fears were confirmed. And we had those repeated drop-offs, but there were also sort of external context to them, in so far as we lost the League Cup final, and you know, I can't even remember the occasions for the second year, but there were reasons why. And I think my suspicion is that it's a physical challenge. It's a real, you know, an athlete's challenge to get through a season with Pochettino, but it's not impossible. And I think that there's very much a crossover of the emotional and the physical there, in that you have to push to get through that year. And if something like losing the League Cup final happens, or dropping at the top four happens, or a major injury happens, that's when you might see a drop-off. But it's far from a guaranteed facet to playing under Pochettino.
And we know that Jesus Perez, who's his kind of second in command, is there constantly monitoring the indicators around fitness and fatigue. And they've certainly, from my perspective, seemed to get better at taking players out of a team when they're struggling for fitness. John, how does that tie into your research around the Bielsa burnout?
Yeah, so there's two facets to this. One of which is, I mean, to contextualize all of this, I think what's really interesting about this is that what people are doing when they talk about burnout is they're trying to develop a narrative. And you guys will know better than anyone that when something goes wrong at the end of a season, people try and pin it down to one thing. So for a while people said, oh, this is a physical burnout for Pochettino's team. Since then, there's been that sort of narrative of, oh, well, you know, that Spurs, they're bottlers. Why I think that's really unhelpful is, like Nathan says, there's so many contextual like particularities that are going on, that could, any of which could impact the scenario, that you've just got to be so careful that when you're talking about an end of season burnout, you are aware of the fact that you have to be nuanced. I mean, look, if you compare any club's record in the last few games of the season, they're going to be impacted by the fact that for the majority of the teams, there's already a foregone conclusion where they're going to end up in the league. So you wouldn't talk about Tony Pulis's team, for example, suffering an end of season burnout, despite the fact that they barely win anything at the end of the season. The narrative there is they're all on the beach already. And I guess that's the frustration that I have. And so I've written a piece recently for the iPaper where I just spent a lot of time just reading into the background of each of the seasons that the Bielsa has done within reason. I didn't go too deep into Mexican football, I must admit. But what I found was that there's two different things. One is that emotional burnout. And that clearly happened in his first season at Newell's Old Boys. And what happens in the Argentinian divisions, the league is divided into two halves. You have the Apertura at the beginning and the Clausura at the end, and if you win one, then you go into the final at the end of the season to decide who's going to be the winner. So if you win the first half of the season, you can then play against the winner of the second half of the season. So in Bielsa's first season, they won the Apertura, so they won the first half of the season. They were already into the final of the championship at that point in that season. And they dropped off in the second half of the season, which I guess makes sense, right? If you already know that you're in the final, you know you're going to be there. It doesn't matter so much about what you're doing. And they ended up winning that. They won the championship, and then they won the game at the end. I think it, I can't remember who it was against. But then they'd sort of got into this dip, and it carried on into the second season. And there's been a fair amount of coverage of this. I think if you the best place to go is probably Jonathan Wilson's. I think it's probably Angels with Dirty Faces, which is the better chapter on this. But they're very similar, the two. Sorry, the other one is Inverting the Pyramid. And Juan Manuel Lop, who is a player under Bielsa, he spends a lot of time talking about how hard it is playing emotionally for someone like Bielsa, who expects all the time the highest efforts and et cetera, et cetera. So that was clearly an example of an emotional fall off. And then they picked up in the second half of that second season. So they had this sort of dip from the second half of the first season through to the first half of the second season. So it doesn't really seem to make any sense that it's exhaustion. And I think a lot of the stuff that was going on behind the scenes seems to suggest that was emotional. And there was so much pressure being put on them. And look, it was his first coaching job at a full club, and so it would make sense that he might get certain things off balance in that time. The other season that gets brought up, and this is an example of physical burnout, is his time at Athletic Club, and you've got Ander Herrera saying basically we couldn't move, and I think the quote was just we were fucked, and it was clear that they had a, like Nathan said, a really busy season. They'd got to the final of the Europa League, although I think it might have been the UEFA Cup at that point. And they got to the final of the Copa del Rey, and they lost both of those finals. One was to Barcelona, and one was to Atletico Madrid. And they lost a few games in a row towards the end of the season. And you kind of think a lot was made of that, because you finally got this Bielsa burnout happening before your eyes in a season. But again, the context behind that is... they lost those games to Barcelona and Atletico Madrid. They're both very good sides. And when they actually finished, they did lose a couple of games towards the end. They dropped a couple of spaces, but their average position really hadn't changed in La Liga throughout the whole year. So, again, whenever I think people are talking about burnout, I think it's just so important to remind people to think, to just think with a pinch of salt, because there's so many underlying and contextual aspects to running a football team, and it's not so simple as just saying, well, you know, Marcelo Bielsa works his players really hard. I spoke to Jed Davis for that piece in the iPaper, and he said, yeah, okay, Marcelo Bielsa has double sessions of training for a long time, but you've got to be aware that a lot of those training sessions will be they'll be without the ball, or they'll be without an opposition, and so they're intense, because you're doing a huge amount of tactical work, but in terms of physicality, they're not actually that physical, precisely because there's an awareness that you can't be too physical. It will have a long-term effect. So yeah, all of these things sort of led me to concluding, as a true academic might, you've got to be careful when you talk about these burnouts. Could Leeds United suffer a burnout? Yes, they could suffer a physical burnout. They could suffer an emotional burnout. Anything could happen. Like Nathan said, we could have injuries. We could have. But Bielsa is idealistic enough that he'll have disagreements with his backroom staff or with his players. That also could happen. And when I spoke to him in a press conference, I asked him about the injuries that Leeds have had this season, because we have a huge amount of injuries. And off the top of his head, he could just reel the average amounts of injuries his team had had, or his squad had had, compared to other teams. He said, we're one of the best squads in terms of injuries. None of our injuries are muscular. They're more knock-based injuries. And so they're clearly aware of what's going on. So I think it's just a case of just watch this space and see if any of these unknowns sort of come into play.
I think to conclude on that, the idea of the Bielsa burnout and for Pochettino too is not baseless. It's not a total myth, yeah. But it's not an absolute lock. You have to look at the context, and also you have to not undermine the really intelligent sports science that's going on in both situations. These aren't idiots just running plays into the ground. There's a lot of complex knowledge involved.
Yep.
It's so fascinating, and in my head I'm already thinking I want John to come back on later in the season and talk about whether this has come to fruition for Leeds and what's happening with their squad at that point. But just to bring it back to a Spurs context, I think it's so fascinating to hear you talk about emotional burnout, and actually I'm already formulating a theory that Pochettino has learnt from this, because he's so focused on the emotional side of his players. That's been actually hugely surprising, because when he turned up, we just assumed that he was going to run them into the ground, have them playing like machines in this ideologue one formation that he sticks to forever, and that's that. And if they're not going to cut it, they're going to go. And we got rid of Kabul, Kapu, etc., etc. Actually, it's not like that at all. He's very hands-on. He's very kind of arm around the shoulder. Man management is his thing. The way he speaks about Dele Alli like a son. And he actually gets inside his players' heads and works out their individual motivations and understands them as people, not just as footballers. I mean, just the weekend just gone, the way he spoke about Ryan Mason, it was beautiful. It was absolutely lovely to see. And maybe that is him learning from the way he was worked under Bielsa, and you know, perhaps Bielsa's moved on as well. But it's also fascinating. Guys, we've been speaking for a long time, but before we go, I just wanted us to answer a question that came in from Ollie Xcore, who's a very, very nice man from Twitter. He sent an email to the Extra Inch at thefightingcock.co.uk, and he wanted to get our thoughts on the FA's plans on expanding the number of homegrown players in Premier League and Football League squads post-Brexit. And I did think this was interesting, and it's something I've long been in favour of from a Spurs youth team perspective and England team perspective. But I'm interested to get your thoughts. Nathan, where do you stand on this one?
Yeah, this idea that sort of a greater limitation on foreign players in Premier League tight. I've tweeted as much, but I think it would be a fucking travesty. I think it would really significantly damage the league. I think that would be based on sort of an arrogance over the quality of English players. Not that we don't have a very good bunch of English players, and not that we shouldn't make better use of our young English talents, but to act like we could maintain the quality of the league after knocking out a third of the foreign talent in the league is simply ridiculous. It's nice to think that these sort of things would help bring through young players, but I think the reality is that with English players becoming an even bigger asset than they currently are, we see the inflated prices for English players versus foreign ones, because you need to fulfill your quotas, that they simply, all the young talent will just migrate towards the Manchester clubs, and they'll still sit on the bench there because that's where all the talent will be. And it will only make it more top heavy. And I don't think that it would lead to more minutes for young players. I think you need to reward the positive rather than punish the negative.
Yeah, that's a solid argument, and it's very difficult to disagree. The only thing I would say is maybe there's a middle ground where, rather than potentially limit the number of foreign players, we actually, something I've always been in favour of is having no limit on the number of players on the bench.
Perfect.
You can have no limit of players on the bench as long as they are English or homegrown and under 21 or something like that, under 23, something like that. I think that's kind of a best of both worlds solution to that problem. John, do you have any particularly strong opinions on this concept?
Yeah, I think it's a weird one. I think this is clearly being done because they're trying to head off, I guess, an assumption they're having that something about work permits is going to change post-Brexit. Mm. And so, because I think I think everyone is aware of the fact that the Premier League is a big product. It is a big chunk of GDP. I know a lot of people pull out all of that stuff about individual supermarkets being more productive in terms of money than the Premier League, but it is a product that and Nathan says, you know, that product would be affected if you started messing around with these levels of British players. I think the frustration for me is I'm a firm believer, as I think you are suggesting you are, Windy, that you need to give youth chance to develop, and that the best chance of development is through playing minutes. Like we know that Dele Alli hugely benefited by the fact that he played over 50 times for MK Dons before he arrived at Spurs. Look at some of the England youth players coming through now, and they are getting time around various clubs in various divisions and now in various leagues in Europe, and I think that's really good. I've already mentioned Lewis Cook. Lewis Cook spent two seasons playing for Leeds in the centre of midfield from the age of 17, and I have no doubt whatsoever that that's why he is so far ahead of the curve, I think, than a lot of other centre midfielders in similar positions. The frustration for me is we seem to have got to a point where we realised that actually the best way of dealing with that was sending players to leagues like the Bundesliga and getting time in foreign leagues. And I think that the problem is that because there can be that sort of almost, I guess, nationalistic pride in when it comes to youth development, the assumption always was, well, if there are kids, we should develop them in our leagues. And I think that's just not true. You can develop whichever league you're in. And the most important thing is you're having competitive football somewhere. And so for me, it's a bit of a shame that we've got to a point where actually, so take the Bundesliga, for example, it's the first time, I think until about 2 years ago, only seven English players had played in the Bundesliga. Now it's 14, two seasons later. And I think that's the turning point that we needed. And it would be a shame then for that to be stopped, because then all the players were brought and, like Nathan says, made to sit on the bench because they're not going to get on, or everyone migrating to Manchester City and then sitting on the bench there. So that would be my thought on this. I think I don't know if it will be a benefit. You know, you're playing with fire when you're just messing things around. I just think that the system that we've got at the moment has reached a good point, and we should mess with it.
Let's not go back to this nationalistic arrogance that we have in terms of saying, okay, yeah, we've had all your fancy foreign coaching techniques and playing styles, we've learned from those and now we've got the best, so we don't need you anymore. That would be a very bad thing. Before we go, guys, can I get an article or a podcast or a book to recommend from both of you for our further reading section? Nathan, I'll start with you.
I'm going to do that really smarmy thing I do where I recommend my guests writing. John's been doing some football and philosophy series stuff for Fansided. You've only got two pieces out so far, but there's maybe going to be more on the way. Is that right, John?
I'm not sure if there is more, but I'm always happy to write more. And they pay well, so it's nice. Awesome. Yeah, I've got two pieces. One of them is looking at particularly Pep Guardiola, which I think is quite accessible for most people. I think the second one's a little bit more philosophical and maybe a little less interesting for people. I looked at the impact that actually Isaac Newton, of all people, had on the way that we talk about how footballers play on the pitch. But yeah, I'm sure you may enjoy those.
I did.
And John, have you read anything that recently that you'd like to recommend?
I'm actually going to recommend a podcast episode. I've just finished listening to Robbie Dunn's No Cheering on the podcast, which is a fantastic podcast because he gets various people from the football media on and just talks to them about books that they've read and gets them to recommend five books that they find formative. And I've just listened to the Jonathan Wilson episode, and that's just a fantastic episode. I really enjoyed that. So that's called the No Cheering on the podcast podcast, and I would recommend that.
Very nice. And I will have to recommend Alistair Gold's interview with Jesus Perez. I don't want to give too much away because I found it absolutely fascinating. There's so much insight there. So I won't say anything further, but do read it. If you're a Spurs fan, it's absolutely essential reading to know more about how he works with Pochettino and the squad. I retweeted it, but if you just look on Google it. Alistair Gold, Jesus Perez.
Football London. It's really, really good.
Really great article, really good interview from Alistair. Thank you very much, guys. John, where can people find you on Twitter and the internet generally?
Yeah, Twitter's the best place. So I'm at John_McKenzie, and John doesn't have an H and McKenzie has an A. So,
so awkward.
Yeah, I know. Something like Cliff Richard or something, isn't it? When he invented his new name, he made sure he didn't have the S on the end, so he had to make a point of saying it. So I always make a point of saying it. You'll remember now.
And Nathan A. Clark on Twitter.
Always.
Always. Thank you very much. It's been a fascinating listen. And John, we must get you back on later in the season. Thanks for your time. Much appreciated. And we'll be back with more episodes in the very near future. Bye for now.
Interesting, mate, yeah.